Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Curious Realm, coming at you live tonight from Austin, Texas. We'll be live next week, is what I mean. We're live, the air quotes are up right now. Technically, we're live every week. I've never done repeat content, anything like that, but typically we've got like the live segment in the first part of the show, followed by a pre-recorded guest. Coming up, though, in January, I will be gone for 21 days to fabulous Las Vegas, and I cannot wait. Going to cover CES for my beloved Talking Sound podcast, and then going to do client work for 2 weeks with my favorite road family in the world. Hey, hope you guys are doing well out there. We'll see y'all soon. Man, it has been exciting. I hope everybody had a fantastic Christmas. I always find it awesome whenever I get to do these episodes over a holiday stretch like this. I always find it awesome whenever we have guests like our first guest coming up here in just a second. Our good friend Brad Olson from CCC Publishing is on the show tonight to talk about anomalies in Antarctica, all kinds of things. We'll be talking about Secret Antarctica in the first part of the episode. In the second part of the episode, we will be joined by our good friend from across the pond in pre-recorded fashion, Graham Phillips, talking about Doggerland, the Atlantis of the North, and how the circle-building cultures, the people who built Stonehenge, things like that, these megalithic sites in the UK actually came down from a previous civilization that existed just north of them in Doggerland. So really amazing stuff. Great book. Fascinating book from Graham Phillips. Check that one out, folks. I want everybody to know as we head into the new year, this is a time for us to think about how we can change the world around us, how we can manifest things in a different way, not just through, you know, the typical New Year's resolution, but how we can actively manifest things in our life and the world around us. And so many of our guests talk about that. So many of our topics talk about that. I myself am a huge believer in that. We are able to do great things when it comes down to, oh, there's Brad. he just popped up on video. So welcome back to the show, Brad Olson. How are you doing, my friend?
Hey, I'm doing good, Chris. Great to be back on the Curious Realms. Last time I was on, we were doing it live together from Stairway to the Stars on the show floor. So
yeah,
I always like to put the face to the name and get to meet the person, and then you get a good feel for what they are in real life. And you are a true seeker of truth and into the darkest, deepest mysteries and all these esoteric subjects that I love so much too. So
absolutely,
we really hit it off well, and great to be back on and have this conversation with you tonight.
Oh, absolutely, man. It was great meeting you for the first time at Stairway to the Stars, actually. That was utterly random. They ended up giving you a VIP pass for the weekend, and it was like, hey, I'm pretty sure that's Brad Olson setting up across the hall. Hold on a second. So it was utterly awesome running into you, getting to just sit back and chat off air, things like that. And yeah, some of your research, especially your research, I mean, most people don't realize that you spent many, many years of your life as a travel writer, going to exotic places, going all around the world. And I mean, that, of course, fed your obsession, fed your side research, which is the world of Esoteria. And I mean, the Beyond Esoteric series is awesome. I cannot wait. I know you are in the midst of writing a new version, a new edition for the series right now. Correct. Right, Brad?
That's right. So the first two are both in second editions, and Beyond Esoteric is the newest. And I have to include a plandemic chapter. It just has to be, Chris, because that's the age we're living in. And
man, it's hard not to, you know, like that whole thing. I was just talking with Clyde Lewis about some of that the other day, and about just the whole concept of control, you know, and yeah, and the idea of how easy it is to move paradigms, especially in this digital age.
Oh, it's all controlled predictive programming, moving us, steering us into a narrative that is state sponsored and cobble approved. Basically, we're finding that anything from the mainstream media, which is well over 90% of all media news sources, is contrived, is crafted. The CIA has their fingers in it with Operation Mockingbird, and it's all just fake news. We all thought that was such a funny phrase when it came out a few years ago, but it's true.
Well, and you know, it's always interesting how phrases like that just kind of take over, Brad. And it's easy for them to take over because they've been used in the background for years and years. And yeah, like we have the documents for Operation Mockingbird up on our knowledge vault, folks. So if you'd like to know about how the CIA actively intended to put reporters in place to put out disseminated messages, things like that, feel free to stop on by the knowledge vault and check out those actual declassified documents, because it's a thing. And, you know, especially when you're talking the realms of science, Brad, when you're talking about that concept of control as a paradigm. And that was especially during that quote plandemic, as you said, that was a big line that got pushed back and forth, left and right the whole time. Was, you know, well, look at the science. Ended up a lot of the science was wrong, you know, and even now, when we're talking about UFOs, UAPs, things like that, to see the head of the NASA panel saying we as scientists have not been doing our job. You know, to see them straight out come up and say, like, yeah, we haven't been investigating the anomaly, and the anomalous is exactly what we're supposed to be looking at, you know.
Oh, yeah. It just has become sublime what the media is putting out as important. For example, Taylor Swift, person of the year, a singer, an entertainer. That's the best you got? There's no one changing the world with technology or a peacemaker that's bringing these senseless wars to an end. Where are those people? No, Taylor Swift.
Yeah, yeah.
Good for her, but I don't buy into it anymore. And most people who are turning to the alternative media, your audience, for example, they're turned off from it too, because it's just nonsensical. It's mental popcorn that's just not, is tastes good, but it's not informing you. It's not giving you the information you need to make the right decisions in life. And because there's so much that has been withheld from us, Chris, you and I are in that camp of being esoteric study. And we're into all the stuff that has been kept from us. And that's literally what the word means. The esoteric sciences to esoteric megaliths, the early builder race to giants. These are all subjects I speak about at conferences. And of course, what's going on down in Antarctica. And there is another book in the offing, probably 2025, that's going to be all about esoteric Antarctica. So we'll have to come back on the show and talk about it when that one comes out.
Well, most definitely. Now, granted, a couple years ago, you actively took an excursion to Antarctica to see some of these places, things like that, to see, I guess, how far down you could get What was that like? I mean, even trying to get down there, like, that can't be, you know, let me pull this travel brochure from the Stuckies, you know, like with the Natural Bridge Caverns flyers and everything else. How do you end up going to Antarctica to begin with, much less going with the intent of trying to check some of these things out, Brad?
Yeah, that's a picture of me that you're using in the promo here, down in Antarctica, posing in front of some of the blue ice. Very, very old ice. As it gets compressed,
yeah,
it turns blue. And the first stop was at the Arctowski Polish Research Station, and they invited us to have dinner and take showers. We got on the internet the one and only time, and it was the introduction of blue ice to a cocktail. You think, oh, that's cool. It's a nice looking chunk of ice. But what it does, it's got all these little air bubbles in it from being compressed. It pops like popcorn.
Oh, wow. And
for the rest of the trip, we would take the dinghy out with an ice pick right up to the wall of get some blue ice for our own cocktails. It was such a novelty. But how I got down there, so it was exactly 5 years ago that I was arriving on Terra del Fuego, and that's the southernmost island, big island in South America, split with Chile and Argentina. And you have to go across the Magellan Straits. I was with my partner at the time, Emily Infinity. She was also at Stairway to the Stars. We're really good friends. Occasionally she'll come up on stage and give the account of how we scored passage on a sailboat with 11 poles and one other American plus us. So three Americans, 11 Poles, 14 of us on a 72-foot sailboat crossing the Drake Passage, the roughest seas of the Southern Ocean, and got terribly seasick on that trip. Yeah, there's Terra del Fuego way down there at the bottom, and the southernmost city is Ushuaia. So at this time, exactly this time, 5 years ago, we were talking to travel agents and finding out about how to gain passage. And at first it seemed like you had to get on a cruise ship. And about 90% of all boat traffic to Antarctica goes out of Ushuaia. And unfortunately, our timing was we were getting there between Christmas and New Year's. So the travel agents all saying, no, you got to come back in February. We're all booked up. There's no way you're not getting up. So for a while there, it was not looking good, but there was one travel agent that said, oh, I heard of a private sailboat at the other pier in Ushuaia, not where all the cruise ships go, but where the sailboats go. Why don't you go check that out? And we did. We walked the pier and we're talking to a captain. He said, well, I got room for one, but I know the boat next to us, the chief one, has room for two. And we met the co-captain and really hit it off. And we went and partied with them on New Year's Eve at the Ushuaia Yacht Club. And I talked to other captains and people that were very familiar with Antarctica that night. And I started my line of questioning. What could be down there? Have you heard anything about massive craft under the ice, to antediluvian civilizations or pyramids poking through, to any paranormal or alien U2-ET activity down there? Routinely, the answer came back no, but I did find out some other really interesting stuff. Yeah, there's one that I know about that's in the Ellsworth Range, and truly the jury's still out on that one, because I showed these images to a travel company that flies trips down there, and they said, oh, that's a nunatak. That's just an attractive mountain poking through the ice. And I said, well, a lot of people, including ancient aliens, are doing a whole show on it as being a crafted antediluvian pyramid. It's a four-sided shaped mountain. They just said, well, that's coincidence. Well, I said, well, have you ever landed the plane and gone down there and checked it out, took a sample, climbed it?
Yeah.
No, we just fly over it. So I think the jury's still out on that. And if I ever did get an opportunity to go back to Antarctica, that is on the itinerary of places I'd like to check out and potentially film. And we have a right now a prospectus going out to some investors about doing possibly even a movie, a documentary about going down there in New Schwabenland and a couple other locations I know about that could make for some very interesting documentary style footage, maybe a TV series as well.
Wow. Yeah. And I mean, there is tons of stuff down there. And yet for now, granted, there have been hypotheses for years. I mean, since Operation High Jump with Admiral Byrd, who, and I mean, of course, his private journal, whether it's real, whether it's not, that's always been a question, whether or not the journal that talks about him flying into a hole and discovering a whole nother world and meeting a group of people, you know, who gave them warning about nuclear weapons, things like that. It's a fascinating story. But aside from that story, there has been, and of course he has the famous quote that, if we don't do something about Antarctica, you know, there will be, weapons flying from pole to pole.
Right.
That we won't be able to stop.
Yeah. And even if the quote was, we'll be facing an enemy that's going to fly beyond the pole to the other pole, well, that kind of means the same thing as flying from the pole at incredible speeds. We're dealing with an enemy that's down at the South Pole. Wow. Okay. Well, it's known fact that Admiral Byrd himself was the very first pilot to fly over the South Pole. Not even just a little more than a dozen years after the Amundsen made it to the pole for the first time in 1913, beating out the Scott Party by 35 hours.
Wow.
And then in 1929, here's Admiral Byrd, who is also an aviator, flying a plane over. So if there was a hole down there, he would have spotted it on that voyage. And so what's interesting about the diary is he is summoned back to fly to the poles. But he only flew with a radio man, and there was definitely 3 hours of missing time when he was around the area of the South Pole. So I like it when data points start to connect, because this is also what the whistleblower Brian S. had to say to Linda Moulton Howe, is that he flew off course and they weren't supposed to, but he got sight of it. And it's a couple miles across. It's big enough that Admiral Byrd felt comfortable dipping his plane down into it, and that's when he entered the domain of the Ariane. And that was flight over the North Pole as well, and he did that. But there's some controversy whether or not he actually made it as far as the North Pole on that flight. Mm-hmm. Some of the time that he listed as flying, he wasn't really in the air that long. So they think he went maybe 150 or 200 miles short of the pole, but he definitely had been over the South Pole and many other parts of Antarctica. He's one of the most well-traveled, especially Antarctica, explorers of all time.
Well, and especially once you start getting into it, just to go back to Linda Moulton Howe real quick and the whistleblowers that have come to her, I am trying to remember the name of them offhand, and I can't. It was one and two.
Spartan one and
Spartan 1 and 2. That was it. Thank you.
Their craft is not too far from the South Pole either. That's in the Beardmore Glacier area, where Brian S. also was witness to flying craft and orb and all sorts of other UFO activity in that general area.
Well, and you know, they talk about a alien base underneath the ice there. Of course, there were rumors of Nazis going to build a base there after Admiral Byrd. That was, of course, a lot of the return trip, which interestingly enough was hugely funded, very well prepared, and came back early. They did not stay for the entirety of their duration. And that was really interesting to see, that as well prepared as they were everything else, that they did not stay for everything. Almost like they were uninvited.
Yeah, by the Antarctic Germans, and perhaps a little help from the Draco reptilian, who supposedly donated the base that they went to in 1938. They were on the New Schwabenland area, so there's the Beardmore right above the Ross ice shelf, and you can see where all the lines point. That's the South Pole. So it's right there in the Trans-Antarctic Mountain. But really on the other side of Antarctica, where you see the map above on the left, that's where the New Schwabenland was. Mm. So if you take that square and just flip it above, that's approximately where the Germans made their claim in 38-39. And the Schwabenland, Schwabia is an area in Germany, New Schwabia. And so it got that name because that was the name of the ship they went down on. But the Schumacher Pons was named after the pilot Schumacher, who landed a seaplane in these geothermal ponds that never freeze, which is part of New Schwabenland. In fact, there's a big fault line that runs right through it. So they would have been able to harness the geothermal energies. Mm. Germans were clever in that way, that they would see an advantage. And there are areas in New Schwabenland that are called Antarctician Island, which is a safe harbor inside a volcanic caldera.
Wow.
That's how big it was. And we went to this location of an old whaling village that did succumb to a pyroclastic flow of another eruption on this volcanic island in the 1960s, wiped out this 19th century whaling village of Norwegians. We saw some gravestones with Norwegian names on it, guys that were just young men that went down there to work and died. But there was an area that, and we were reading in the Lonely Planet book, there's a whole Lonely Planet Antarctica, about 256 pages, that you could strip down and lay down in this one area and get a hot spring. We were there when the tide was coming in, so it wasn't warm enough to do that. But we walked around with our shoes off, and it was warm enough to feel warm water. So that's another place that's an Antarctic oasis that never freezes, and that's why the whalers set up their shop there, and there are still bases there to this modern day. Deception Island's in that tip of South America where it reaches out to the Palmer Peninsula. Mm. Deception Island's right on the tip of the Palmer Peninsula there. And what a cool spot to visit as well.
Well, and, you know, these spots, specifically the New Schwabenland base, things like that, Brad, how have they gone? How have they managed to defy detection? How are they entrenched with, I guess, modern technology, things like that, if they are so far removed?
You mean the German base in New Schwabia?
Yeah, and even the, well, I guess the other base would be an alien base, so at least by reports.
But there were two named German bases. Mm. The one base near the Schumacher Pons was called Base 211, and that's the base that I think was part of the Battle of High Jump, that they found some outbuildings and were going to bomb the area. But really, the Base 211 was donated by the Dracos. They had an unused base down there, and that's what the Schumacher party, after they landed on the lake, went out to find. They knew the coordinates. They knew how to get there. They found a land entrance into and through, but they also had the U-boat entrances of the very advanced submarines that could go under the ice undetected. So talk about a great hideout. In fact, Admiral Dolence, the Navy commander, made a very interesting statement in 1943. I'll paraphrase it. I don't know it word for word, but basically he said, "We have discovered in a land of eternal ice and have built an impregnable fortress for the Fuhrer," in 1943. And either that's Greenland or that's Antarctica.
Wow.
Down in Base 211. But the other base that's often referred to is called the New Berlin Base. And I do believe that is the domain of the Ariana under the ice in the South Pole, because in Admiral Byrd's diary says he's flying in and they lose control of the plane. So this is also very advanced technology for 1946. To be able to remote control a plane, and that's what happened. But two discs with Nazi insignia flew wingtip to wingtip, and they came over the radio with a German accent and said, "You're in good hands, Admiral Byrd. We will be landing at Ariana in the domain in 5 minutes." And then they come down, and then the guys came out of their UFO craft with a German Nordic accent, big, tall, blonde guys, and then escorted Admiral Byrd to a meeting with the master. And the master emphasized how concerned they were with nuclear bombs that had just gone off the year before in Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, this seems to be a recurring theme, especially when talking about alien intelligences, things like that. The fact that there are a group of them that are kind of watching over humanity. And as they said, supposedly that they'd never interfered with humanity. They'd never wanted to interfere with humanity. But when it came to this, it was something that they could not let slide, so to speak. And once again, very, very often the message from contactees, things like that, the idea that we are either destroying the Earth or going to destroy ourselves with nuclear weapons.
Right. And that was the warning that was given to Admiral Byrd. He asked, "Why did you choose me? Because you're so well respected, and we want you to go back to your other leaders in the Pentagon and let them know that we are very concerned with nuclear war." In Beyond Esoteric, I have a chapter called Alternative 1, 2, and 3. And Alternative 1, well, there are all these harebrained ideas of the globalists that we're going to blow up and destroy the planet. And so they needed some solutions. They called Alternative 1, 2, 3. Alternative 2 was digging all the deep underground military bases, in which many of the paperclip Nazis that came over here were engineers in the TOT organization, and they helped engineer our whole network. Alternative 3 is moving off planet, Laura Eisenhower being recruited in the Mars program, and then other super soldiers and whistleblowers from the secret space program talk out about going off planet. And that technology has been around for decades. But in Beyond Esoteric, I point out that Alternative 1, which was this globalist harebrained idea that we're going to blow up nukes in the upper atmosphere to let all the pollution out. And they did. And that was called Operation Argus. And I profile it in this chapter in Beyond Esoteric, because really what it was it was finally nuking the base 211 and taking that out once and for all. So if I were to go down there, I would want to go to New Schwabenland. And of course, we'll bring some Geiger counters. If we could detect radiation in this area, that could really blow the lid off the story of what Operation Argus was and how that really ended the Germans' time, at least in base 211. But they already wanted to go, Chris. And they also set up bases, really micronations, in several countries in South America, that being Brazil, Argentina, and Chile, which had very strong fascist leanings as well with the governments of those countries.
Yep.
And they set up these micronations. Chris, I was looking at maps, poring over maps before I went down there, and finding there are whole areas that are the size of some of our small states, like Connecticut and Rhode Island, set up in these three countries, and Paraguay as well, where they own huge land holdings and they operate outside the jurisdiction of the host country in many cases. So that's also where the Nazis went after World War II.
Yeah, there were numerous. I'm trying to remember the show on History Channel where they acted. I think it may have just been Hunting Nazis, where they actively went to the castle in Brazil that was supposedly where Hitler went and, you know, resigned for the rest of his life. So to speak. And there are not even stories about that. That is absolute 100% fact that, we helped Nazis come over here. They were the bread and butter foundation of our space program. Yeah. Without them, we would have never achieved orbit. without people like Wernher von Braun, stuff like that. And granted, you know, we say Nazi when it comes to Wernher von Braun, but I think that's a little hard sold sometimes. There was kind of the idea of, well, you can either work for us or you can, you know, there's a train going the other way. We could hop you right on that if you want.
Head over to Russia. They'll take you.
Yeah. We got a one-way ticket to Poland for you.
Right.
Was pretty much the way it worked. So, to say Nazi scientist, I think once again is hard pressed, but at the same time, yeah, you know, that is without him, there was no V2 rocket. There was no V2 rocket program. And without the V2, we would have never achieved orbit, much less the Saturn V. So, yeah, it's interesting to see how all of that and their data was fully culled into our technology. And at the same token, how they had active plans to go to South America, go to the tip of known civilization, and even have bases in Antarctica. And to know that, yes, there is an Antarctic no-fly zone. That there is the Wilkes Land anomaly, which is an impact crater, but it's really interesting. Some of the strange magnetic anomalies that are happening around this impact crater, which lead people, of course, to say what impacted and what is in the crater.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I do a whole 90-minute presentation at conferences called The Hidden Anomalies of Antarctica, and really it could be 3 hours. There's so many things to talk about down there.
Well, and, you know, especially once you start looking at how can we, I guess, what evidence do we have that anything actively took place down there, Brad, that there are active bases down there?
Well, there's absolute proof that the Germans were going down there pre-World War II. They had the technology, including the submarines, to really probe the continental landmass and go under the ice and look for escape ways and caves. And I mean, that would be a fascinating movie just in and of itself about how they were able to explore especially this New Schwabenland area. But we went to a couple bases on the Palmer Peninsula that were set up during Operation Tamberlin, which is the British spy network during World War II, spying on the Nazi base. And they knew where the other one was, because the distances are so vast there that it would have been hard for either one to either try to invade or bomb the enemy. But that's what Operation High Jump was afterwards, to finally root out the Nazi presence in Antarctica, but specifically to capture one of these flugel rods that was named that Admiral Byrd gave to these two UFOs that escorted him into the domain. And their orders were to capture one of these so we can backward engineer it ourselves. And isn't it interesting, in the very same year that Operation High Jump ended at the beginning of 1947, we have the Roswell crash that summer in 1947,
yep,
as well as many other crash retrievals, including the one in Aztec, New Mexico, which is when they really had to put the lid on all these crash retrievals. Because in the Aztec crash, they found human body parts, and they knew that that was going to freak out the public. So the book by Colonel Corso is called The Day After Roswell. Mm. Certainly that is the day when the cover-up began, but it really became a cover-up after the Aztec crash, this according to Bill Cooper and others, because of what they found inside there. And that's why the NSA was formed. The No Such Agency, which was formed under Truman, concurrent with the CIA. So the CIA was going to go do all that spy craft overseas, but the NSA was set up initially specifically to cover up any UFO crash scene to acquire the craft, to bring it to our scientists, including live and dead alien bodies that would mostly go to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. And what's interesting with the revelations from David Grush this past summer, testifying in front of Congress, that that's exactly what he was doing, was these crash retrievals and also dealing with live and dead ET bodies. So it really is coming full circle here, Chris, that a lot of the stuff we've been hearing about for decades is now coming true.
Well, yeah. And, you know, once again, the technologies that they talked about, that people like Admiral Byrd talked about way back then. And when you start looking at some of the extreme technologies that the Nazis were looking into, especially toward the end of the war, things like Der Glocke, stuff mm-hmm. like that may well been based on Vimana technology, based on the I guess kind of red mercury engine, spinning mercury inside of a high torsion magnetic field, things like that could either lead to anti-gravitic or even time travel, so to speak. I mean, that's always been one of the questions about the Kecksburg UFO incident, is that the Kecksburg UFO is very similar to the descriptions of Der Glocke that have been given.
Here's a illustration. This is actually a photograph of it in Beyond Esoteric.
Wow.
This is the high technology that got shepherded out of Nazi Germany, but they were working on it from 33 until 45. Nazi German scientists either discovered from prehistory an advanced civilization with some kind of UFO. You mentioned a Vimana, and they were in Tibet. They were all over India and elsewhere trying to track down any kind of technological advance that would give them the edge in the war. So they were certainly looking for this, including in the Middle East. Or they simply used all this scientific discoveries in Europe from the 18th century onward and built the Honeyboo system of crafts, using momentum in an anti-time dragged static bubble. That's basically how they flew the Die Glock, to some degree based on the Helmholtz resonance theory. Other branches of science evolved into the radar system of the magnetotron and the potential time travel and space travel machine called the Bell.
Yeah.
Germans developed highly advanced space programs with bases in Antarctica and even on Mars, where they first developed nanotechnology. If history was truly to be told, Chris, the Germans were the first to the moon and the first to another planet in our solar system. Nobody wants to admit it, that the Nazis were that advanced, but they even admitted that they got help. Hermann Oberth, who is also a paperclip Nazi that went over and started NASA with Wernher von Braun, when asked, how do you guys get so advanced? How'd you get this so fast above anybody else by leaps and bounds? And he said, well, we did have help from our friends from above. And just admitting that they had backward engineered their own craft, but also were making contact with certain ET groups and getting a technology exchange that way too.
Yeah.
Just like our Griotta Treaty, which is what the U.S. government has been engaged at since the 1930s, almost 100 years of this illegal treaty to get technology in exchange for letting some of these malevolent ETs do the human abduction, the cattle mutilations, and all that other weird stuff.
You know, it is really interesting. I have spoken with a remote viewer who's pretty prominent in the remote viewing community, one of the, quote, OGs, as you would say, a member of Project Stargate, things like that. And I asked him at one point in private conversation, Brad, if he had ever tried to remote view alien species, anything like that. And he was like, well, actually, yeah. And here's what I got. And it was fascinating to hear him talk about how basically, yes, there has been a reverse engineering program that these things have been supplied to the government. And that the whole reason that this reverse engineering program happens is because these species, in order to become as advanced as they've become, in order to, you know, get past the point of ego and be at the point of pure id, so to speak, they had to give up things like individuality, creativity, things like that, in order to live in this perfect unity, no longer need spoken language, things like that. So they had these amazing technologies, but they can no longer leverage them in new ways to help, to help even themselves. So they are using us and our ingenuity to engineer new means by which to use their technology to even help them. And I thought that was pretty incredible, to even hypothesize, and groundbreaking to think about that. Yes, if there was, such as you're saying, and as many have said, the Granada Agreement, where our government is in a union with alien species saying, yes, okay, you can kidnap a certain number of people. You can mutilate a certain number of cattle if this is what you need to do for your science, your species, things like that. But we need a cooperative quid pro quo amongst this. So, yeah, the idea that our government or government entities or contractors are helping them right, reverse engineer this for their own use, is pretty interesting.
And throwing a bunch of paperclip Nazis who also had the wherewithal. You know, in the mid 1930s, there was a nearly intact craft that came down in Lombardy region of Italy. And Mussolini, he didn't have scientists anywhere near the Germans. And of course, the Axis powers were joining forces. He allowed the German scientists access to this craft, and they also used their scientific know-how to backward engineer this stuff to also put it into their own prototypes. And some of those prototypes of the Honeyboo craft, they were actually seen in a couple different battles at the very end of World War II, not in a combat mode, but more in a surveillance. And there were even some videos and photographs and diagrams and plans, yeah, such as I have here. Fortunately, I have the screen on like a blur, so it's not coming in.
That's okay, bud.
Too well. But that's basically the Honeyboo craft. And those could very well have been the craft that attacked the High Jump Armada, which, as you mentioned, ended its 6-month excursion just after 2 months. In fact,
yeah,
very much high-tailed it right out of there.
Yeah, it was just about a turnaround.
Yeah.
Like, all but. They did not have time to set up base, set up camp fully, anything like that. It was pretty strange to see how fast they literally high-tailed it out of High Jump. And once again, I just had the Popular Mechanics article up about the UFO researcher talking about the evidence from the crash in Italy in 1933. And yeah, the Italian government has tons of information, remarkable information about things. They have been openly researching stuff for decades, and were one of the first countries to really put things out in that way, without FOIA request, that kind of stuff. So it is remarkable to see these things happening, Brad. At the same time, it's disturbing to me to see things like terms like UFO denier being used just to bring this back to the beginning of the conversation, and means of control and dialogue control, things like that, to see how quickly that tide turned media wise, where it was no longer, you know, crazy Uncle Kyle down the road who saw a critter come out of his barn, you know, but people being taken seriously and reports being taken seriously. It's great to see that. But at the same time, some of it is also disconcerting to me, like the recent article about the UFO hovering over Air Force One just outside of LAX. You know, a lot of the dialogue right now in those congressional hearings and everything has been air defense, air sovereignty, what's in commercial airline traffic, things like that, dangers to airline traffic. And to see that headline being put right out there was like, wow, look at that. You couldn't get a greater threat. Now you've officially made them a threat to democracy.
Yeah.
You know, like by doing that, you officially made UFOs a threat to democracy. Like they were possibly threatening the president of the United States. Never mind the actual witnesses of fleets of UFOs. Right. In the D.C. area over the White House in the 1950s.
Yeah, 1952. And that's a huge moment when you have all the newspapers in America running pictures of a dozen or so craft flying right over the Capitol building. So for a long time, everybody's thought, whoa, invasion of UFOs. We can't even protect our own airspace over the Pentagon in Washington. Well, now I would say most UFO historians worth their weight in salt understand that those were the Antarctica Nazis. Those were the honeyboo craft. And in Laura Eisenhower's new book, which I'm publishing at CCC Publishing, it's called Into the Truth Frequency. She is getting into some really unknown Eisenhower whistleblower historians who are saying he was forced into a raw deal. Because after that flyover of D.C. in the summer of 52, Truman was still president.
Yep.
Truman chickened out. He was so scared that he signed surrender agreements to the Antarctica Nazis. And this is the whole notion of the Fourth Reich, or the Third Force, as Henry Stevens puts it in his great book, Dark Star. But Washington, D.C. flyover. That was the Antarctica Nazis flying pole to pole at incredible speed.
Wow.
And so in her new book, she has some new evidence that Truman surrendered. He kicked the can to Eisenhower, who had to deal with a raw deal. And I think in many ways, Eisenhower is being vindicated because he also inherited the Griotta Treaty. They say he initiated it. He did not initiate it. It started in 1934 down in the country of Panama on an aircraft carrier in the very early years. So now with the Lombardy region UFO in 1933, we're talking about 90 years of interacting with aliens and backward engineering their technology. You can imagine how advanced it is today. Well, it was just last May, Chris, that Lester Holt gets on the NBC Nightly News and says the Pentagon has just released a report that there's a mothership in our solar system.
Yeah.
And this is just a one and done story, just one time. And how come we're not still talking about this? This should be the biggest news story in the history of humanity. But it was just one and done on NBC Nightly News.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting to see that because it's almost like these things are litmus test, Brad. I have worriedly been holding in the back of my mind for the last 2 to 3 years, Project Bluebeam, man. Especially since that whole lockdown. And especially since, I mean, just doing the work that I do, knowing the technology that's out there, audio-wise, video-wise, knowing the fact that we now have holograms that you can physically shake hands with and feel the hand. We have holograms that you can hear. So it's there's a whole new realm of technology out there that can be used, especially when you're talking about deep fake, when you're talking about AI, some of that kind of stuff, man. It's disturbing how fast it can come out and how real it can be. And that in and of itself is changing the paradigm and the conversation on the daily, and even getting people to the point of sadly being blasé about the amazing. Because is it live or is it Memorex, man? Like, I don't even know anymore, and do I even care?
Well, it's the strange world we live in, the zeitgeist of the ages, as the Germans coined. And yeah, it's just a really amazing time to be alive and watch all this start to come out, but also to be vindicated that we were talking about this 10, 20 years ago, and so many people just threw the bucket of cold water on everything we had to say. And now it's coming out that we were right all along. And neither one of us are one of those who are saying, "See, I told you so." But it kind of is a "see, I told you so" moment when all of this starts coming out. And this is the most important discussion we should be having, is what are these things? Who are these inhabitants?
Yep.
What are they doing here in a mothership out by Jupiter? How isn't the whole scientific community jumping on this and examining this from every level? And news reports every night, "Oh, the mothership moved to the orbit of Mars. It's coming up this way," right? Don't we have a right to know this? Isn't this important?
Well,
that should be on 60 Minutes and all these other news programs too.
Well, even the conversation of Oumuamua, Brad, and the idea of if that was an alien probe, active probe, defunct probe, what have you, was it a natural object? Because it definitely didn't seem to have a natural pass-by. You know, right. Its flight characteristics, things like that, definitely didn't seem that way. And when you start talking about things, even when you start talking about the ways in which we explore places, you know, especially distant places, We're prone to send a probe or two before we just arrive on scene. You know, even if we've been there, we'd prefer to send a probe or two just to make sure things are still at aspect, so to speak. And to think that isn't happening here, to think that it isn't happening on our planet, I think is horrendously short-sighted, is the only way I can put it. I am of the mind that the job of science is to hypothesize anything and everything. That is quite literally the job of science. You're allowed to hypothesize anything you want. It's through testing and experimentation that a hypothesis becomes a proof and a theorem, you know, and a theory. That's just the scientific process. So to dismiss these things, to say out hand, like we were saying at the beginning of the show, that the possible pyramids in Antarctica couldn't be pyramids to begin with, is unscientific, because you're eliminating a possibility that, you know, could be. So,
yeah, worth further study.
Absolutely, man. I want to thank you for always coming on the show, talking about these amazing things, because once you start looking into the entire world of things that have been hidden, obfuscated, the knowledge that has been swept under just the corner of the rug, Brad. Like, they most of it, they didn't even try really hard to sweep away, you know? It's right there. It is readily accessible. So, thank you so much as always for coming on, talking about this stuff. We definitely need to have you back on sooner than a year. That is for certain, man. I always love our conversations. When can we be looking at the new edition in the Esoteric series?
Well, it's going to be the second edition of Beyond Esoteric, okay. But it won't be out until 1 year from now. Publishing books is a long-term process, so Beyond Esoteric is still available, and then the other two are also second edition now, and they can all be found at cccpublishing.com. And if you go there and you order a book off this website, that goes through my office, so I'm able to sign copies for people and get them out in pretty quick manner. We just published Michael Jaco's new book, Awakening of a Warrior. Awesome. Really cool book. I added all the photos and captions and maps to that new book, and I wrote the foreword to Intuitive Warrior. I also wrote the foreword to Laura Eisenhower's new book, giving some perspective on her great grandfather and the family she was born into, and a lot of inside information that could only come through an Eisenhower.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll have to talk with you off air at some point about getting both of them on. I've wanted to talk with Michael Jaco for a long time about his work and especially about his work with, tuning into human intuition, things like that, out in the wild. And man, the idea of what was actually boiling in Eisenhower's head. I make reference all the time, Brad, to his departure speech, but in a different way. And in the fact of, if you go through and listen to that whole speech, he is pleading. He is literally pleading with the American people of, please do not forget the rights that we had to sign away. Don't forget that. Go reclaim them. Keep these people from running your life for you. And his utter warning of that is so beautiful and still so impending. So thank you so much for helping her get her book and that message out to such a larger audience, man. The work of CCC Publishing is absolutely awesome and utterly necessary in the world. So thank you for all that you do on that front.
Well, thank you for those kind words, Chris. And you're doing a great job with the Curious Realms. And we're all part of the same solution. And that's just helping people understand this very pivotal moment in human history that we're seeing right before our very eyes. So you're doing your part. I'm doing my part. I'm working in the book side. You're working on the podcast side. And it's all for the same purpose. And that's the Great Awakening.
That's right.
Right before our very eyes.
That's right. Well, Brad, once again, thanks so much for your time. I'll be sharing links to all of this as always. We will be in touch very soon to get you back on.
Sounds great, Chris. Thanks for having me on tonight. It was a great conversation with you again.
All right, man. Take care. We'll talk to you soon, bud.
Okay. Good night.
Always a great conversation with Brad Olson. Absolutely incredible stuff. And when you start looking at just the history of Antarctica, you know, that is the most or the least explored location on our planet next to the depths of our ocean. So there's just a massive, massive amount there to look at. His work in that field is amazing. And thank you so much, Brad, for coming on tonight to talk about that. Make sure while you are online checking out all of the amazing work of CCC Publishing, everybody. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can find all the episodes. That is where you can find our knowledge vault full of declassified government materials, things like that, all kinds of great PDFs there that you can read. When we come back from this commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend from across the pond, Graham Phillips. We will be discussing the mystery of Doggerland, the Atlantis of the North, and how a lost civilization is tied to all of the stone circles and other megaliths that you see in the UK and in the surrounding area. We will be getting into that with Graham Phillips right after this, everybody. Hello, everybody, and welcome back from that commercial break. Thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is your source for amazing CBD products. Make sure to stop on by TrueHempScience.com. That is the website. That is where you can get 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two free edibles with the code CURIOUS7. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Graham Phillips. He is the author of the new book, Mystery of Doggerland, Atlantis of the North Sea. He has been on the show talking about Stonehenge, ancient civilizations, Moses' staff. He's been on talking about the Holy Grail, which he has in his possession. All kinds of things. Welcome back to the show, Graham Phillips. How are you doing, my friend?
Very well, thank you. And yeah, great to be back on.
I love our conversations. You are hands down one of my favorite researchers to read. You have an amazing narrative style and a way of really laying out some very thick information in very common sense ways. The whole idea of Doggerland and this previous civilization that predated like the people that built Stonehenge, things like that, is phenomenal and amazing. How did you first come across this information, Graham?
Well, I mean, I'd heard of Doggerland. I mean, what it is that during the last ice age, I've got to remember I'm actually being filmed for this. I'm not on the radio. I was just going to do that when I'm on the radio.
You're okay.
So, during the last ice age, there was so much water tied up in ice that sea levels were about 400 feet lower than they are today. And because of this, all this land that you can now see on the screen that surrounds the British Isles was above water. And it had been above water for many thousands of years. And people migrated mainly from mainland Europe, the Netherlands, Denmark, and so on, and moved into this area. And then around about 10,000 BC, the water level started to rise at the end of the last ice age. And over many centuries, a lot of this land began to sink until around 6,000 BC, for a couple of thousand years, the water levels remained pretty much the same. There was a kind of, you know, it had heated up enough and it kind of stayed there for a while. Didn't all happen in one go. And there was part of that Doggerland area left. It was an area about the size of Rhode Island, which was just off the northeast coast of Scotland. And so if you look at the top of Scotland there and you imagine I can see you pointing the pointer, point higher, right to the top. There, just off your map to the north are some islands. And up there, yeah, that's where it was, that bit there. Remained above sea level. Now, you'll see there that the darker areas are what was considered to be the higher land. So you'd have thought that the light green areas would have sunk earlier.
Sure.
But no, what they've discovered now or more recently is that because of the pressure of 2 miles of ice that used to cover North Britain, these huge glaciers, the whole of the place in the north of Britain was kind of squashed downwards. And then when the ice melted relatively quickly, over a period of time, the land gradually rose, which meant that when all these other areas were submerged, north of Scotland remained an island. And this island called North Doggerland is the area that it seems that some ancient civilization emerged sometime between 6,000 and 4,000 BC, perhaps earlier. And how did I find out about this? Because, I mean, at first, everyone just thought, well, it was a land, there was nothing going on there. But how it was first discovered that there might have been a civilization there pretty advanced for the time, was when a stone circle similar to Stonehenge, that sort of thing, was found underneath the sea on the seabed that must have sank at least 4,000 years ago. Wow. And this was found on what was North Doggerland. That was found in 2011, and that's kicked the whole thing off.
Wow. And once again, to see ruins like that underneath, under the water, from that age, I mean, how old are they presuming that this civilization might be? I mean, Bronze Age, older than that? Is this something that they would actually call a civilization as of right now?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, okay, let's put this in a kind of context.
Please.
The oldest civilizations in the true sense, like ancient Egypt and Greece and Rome and things like that, the oldest of those kind of civilizations with great infrastructures, with sort of roads for transportation, but with camels or horses or whatever, and municipal areas, big temples, cities. Their first of those is known to have been a place called Sumer, which is in what is now southern Iraq. That area around there, about the area of what's now Iraq, which is known as Mesopotamia, a number of civilizations emerged over the years, like Babylons, the Assyrians, and Babylonians, and so on. But the first of these was a civilization called Sumer, which seems to have come around about 3000 BC, that's 5000 years ago, in that area. Now, at pretty much the same time, the first civilization began in Egypt, and this was, and also at the same time in northern India, in what's now Pakistan, there was a civilization called the Indus Valley Civilization. They all seemed to come around about the same time. And shortly after this, they began to be able to manufacture bronze. So they had the kind of tools to create decent civilizations. Right. That's the kind of basic history of things. The civilization that built Stonehenge, known as the megalithic people of Britain, they didn't have all these massive kind of municipal buildings and big cities and all this sort of stuff. But what makes them a civilization is they seem to have had the same sort of religious and cultural practices all over the British Isles, rather than just be a small tribal grouping of people. Mm. Now, they first came around about the same time, around 3000 BC, as the first Egyptians, the first Sumerians, and the Indus Valley culture arose. What they did, I mean, everyone knows about Stonehenge, but that was just one of thousands of stone circles built throughout the country. It's far from the largest. The largest is about 20 miles north of Stonehenge at a place called Avebury. And the Avebury stone circle, I mean, Stonehenge is about 100 feet across, which is what's on the screen now. That's an old drawing of it, what it might have originally looked like. So it's about 100 feet across. Avebury Stone Circle, 20 miles to the north, is 1,000 feet in diameter. It's made up of over 100 stones, some weighing up to 40 tons. It doesn't have those lintel stones, the arches on the top like that has, but it's absolutely huge. I mean, it's got a ditch and embankment around it, which is about 30 feet deep and 30 feet high, wow, which would have been much deeper and higher going back in to the time it was built. And that is just part of a huge megalithic complex around Avebury. There's an artificial hill there called Silbury Hill, which is over 300 feet tall. Archaeologists have dug inside it, found absolutely nothing to explain why it's there. No burial chambers or anything lie within. It's also got avenues of stone leading away from the main stone circle to smaller satellite circles a couple of miles away. This is what's called a megalithic complex. And there were dozens of those throughout the country, perhaps one for each tribal area. And in addition to that, there were lots and lots of individual smaller stone circles, perhaps, 20 feet across, 30 feet across, made up of 10 stones, about 4 feet tall. Thousands of these all across the country. And they started to be built about 3000 BC. And they carried on being built until around about 1000 BC. So for 2000 years, this was people were doing the same thing, building the same kind of stone circles all over the British Isles, England, Wales, Scotland, Ireland. And this just went on. So even though they didn't build fantastic cities, they were a civilization in as much that they all basically did the same thing for 2,000 years. And yeah. They built some pretty impressive monuments. So that is the megalithic culture. No one knows where it came from.
Yeah.
They used to think that it started in the southwest Stonehenges, that people came across from northern France. But now, because of the development of modern dating techniques, they know that it started in the north and then gradually moved south. In fact, the very oldest stone circles are on the Orkney Isles, just north of Scotland, very close to what was once Doggerland. And it's possible that the civilization came from Doggerland once it sank and started off again in northern Scotland.
Wow. Wow. And, you know, reading through the book, there were some very interesting parallels, especially in the Orkney Isles with graves, content of graves, things like that, that we discussed in Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge, specifically herbs, toxic herbs, things like that. Like, you would have to have a specific knowledge of how and when to harvest these for them to have their medicinal benefit and not be toxic to you. Things like much like it was in Stonehenge, like mistletoe berries, things like that. What are the similarities there between items found in graves in the Orkney Isles and thereby Stonehenge, Avery, and stuff like that?
Well, the pottery that's been found in the graves, people who were buried in sort of elaborate sort of little tomb things, were basically the priestly people, the people who were ruling society, the people who basically knew what was going on and were respected. And they were very often healers. And so consequently, in their graves, they were also buried with the implements of their trade, so to speak, such as pottery containing medicinal herbs. Now, what's fascinating about this is modern archaeology has examined the contents of these pots and discovered through scientific analysis that they contain substances that would be poisonous under normal circumstances. You wouldn't eat them, certain types of berries and roots from different plants and so forth, that you wouldn't eat even for hallucinogenic purposes. You know, they were simply the only way that they could have been used as if they were used for pharmaceuticals like pain relief, getting rid of stomach problems, helping with breathing conditions. All of these different types of substances were found in the graves. And these are sort of things that weren't rediscovered until during Roman times, 3,000 years later. And some of them weren't even rediscovered until the 19th century, such as analgesics to conquer pain. Yeah. So these people were surprisingly advanced. The pottery they had, incidentally, was far more sophisticated than anything anyone else in the world at that time. Even the pottery of Sumer in Egypt was not as sophisticated and the people of Egypt and Sumer couldn't create kilns to reach the kind of temperatures necessary to fire the very sturdy pottery that the people of Britain were making at that same time. So in some ways, they were more advanced than the Egyptians and the Sumerians. They were more advanced in their herbal medicines. They didn't have the kind of building skills that the Egyptians had, but they still, considering this much lower populations and the fact that they were using Stone Age tools, built some remarkable monuments. Now, what's fascinating is that this would have taken centuries to develop, trial and error for the medicines for a start. A lot of people would have had to have eaten this stuff and dropped dead before people knew you weren't supposed to eat that stuff. A lot of research needed to have been done over years, same with the building techniques and everything else. But in the Orkneys, where the very oldest stone circles are in the country, 3,100 years old, 5,100 years old, 3,100 BC, these stone circles suddenly sprung up from nowhere. There's a stone circle on the Orkneys, which is very similar to the Avebury megalithic complex I described earlier, called the Ring of Brodgar. These first stone circle complexes on the Orkneys were built in 3100 BC. Stonehenge and Avebury weren't built until 600 years later. So right early on, this amazingly advanced civilization for the time appeared completely overnight. They got this built. They got the building techniques. They got the sophisticated pottery. They got the herbal medicines. But there's no evidence that it gradually developed on the Orkneys. There's the picture of the stone circle on the Orkneys, known as the Ring of Brodgar, very similar to Avebury and all these other stone circles throughout the country. The ditch and embankments surrounding it. The circle of stones. It also joined, but there was an avenue of stones that originally joined it to a nearby stone circle called the Stones of Stennes. There's a nearby artificial hillock which has been excavated and there's nothing inside. The typical megalithic complex. This was the first of them, and it appeared overnight. No development gradually building up to this. So if it kind of developed in any way at all, it must have developed elsewhere than in Britain. And there's no evidence of this kind of thing in Scandinavia or Northern Europe. So the only place it could have developed is on the sunken island of Doggerland.
Wow. Wow. And you know, once again, the very interesting thing about these stone circles is, yes, it's not like there are cities around them. It's not like they camped around them. There may be, once again, a few grave sites of magicians, things like that, holy men. But aside from that, it's not like there are mass graves of people that live there or, you know, signs of settlement in the direct area. It's really interesting.
Yeah, they didn't actually build them where they actually lived. They built them out in the wilds, but for whatever reason, it seems that possibly the reason for some of them, that doesn't explain all their monuments, is that if you stand in the middle of these stone circles, the stones can be used so that you can judge in the sky where the stars are at any particular time of the year, to such a degree that you can actually say, you can know exactly what day it is and what time of what day it is. And the reason for this may have been because of the very precise cultivation procedures that you need to create some of these medicinal substances. I mean, you may have to cut a particular, I mean, the Romans, many, many years later, talk about the Druids of Britain, who seem to have been people who inherited some of this knowledge from their predecessors, the megalithic people. I mean, the Druids were Celtic people, and the Celts first came to Britain about 700 BC. They took over perhaps some of what the megalithic people before them were doing. And the Romans say that they had to cut mistletoe. You mentioned mistletoe, had to cut it a very certain time of the year for something in the flowers that only open at certain times of the year to release a scent to attract night pollinating moths. And that particular scent, the substance in that, is what's used to create an analgesic, which completely mystified the Romans. And they said for some reason, somehow, the Druids, who didn't have any form of writing of their own or no instruments that they knew of, were able to sort of know exactly what time and at what day they had to harvest this. They got it wrong. They'd poison people.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating.
There are numerous plants that you mention, Datura being one of them, which no longer grows in the Isles, all over North America, used well, by Native Americans, things like that. Thorn apple, as it's commonly called.
Yeah. Yeah, the thorn apple was used by Native Americans to, it can induce hallucinations, but it's also used as an analgesic an antiseptic, but not antiseptic. What's that thing that knocks you out?
Anesthetic.
Anesthetic, that's what I'm trying to think of. And it's part of, the Romans actually say that the Druids could amputate limbs without causing pain. When the Romans did that, they could do is get you drunk, and that didn't always work.
Yeah, and just hold you down.
Hold you.
And, you know, specifically when it comes to harvesting these things, being able to have the alignments to the stars and knowing the position of these takes an extreme knowledge of your place in the cosmos and how things move around you. We talk about it regularly on the show that we've kind of lost this connection. You know, I mean, even my grandfather, who grew up as a sharecropper in Louisiana, like, he had a different connection. Like, he didn't need a farmer's almanac to know when to put beets in the ground to make sure that they grew. His grandfather told him when to put beets in the ground because this is when they'll grow best, you know. And once again, the fact that this knowledge was passed down, not only from Doggerland, but to ancient Britain and then on to Druids, things like that. I guess, how do we show the way that this has, I guess, tracked back to a lost civilization, Graham?
Okay, about the Druids, for a start, they were the kind of priesthood of the Celtic people. They claimed, according to what the Romans tell us, but by the way, they had absolutely no form of writing in Britain until the Romans arrived, which is 2,000 years ago. They didn't have it, and the reason they didn't have it is because the Druids were people who were trained since birth. They lived in communities apart from the rest of society, both men and women, and their children were trained since birth to develop amazing memory techniques like some stage performers now do, when they can remember pack of cards after pack of cards, sure, with these, you know, all in order after seeing it once, with these mnemonic techniques, as they're known, also forms of hypnosis. And they learned how to be, and because they were able to become the storehouse, the living libraries of the Celtic people, for example. They hadn't got anyone to remember how to do various things, their history, their laws. They couldn't be written down, so they had to be memorized by the Druids, who were the kind of living libraries, if you like. Now, they claimed, at least the Romans say, that the Druids claimed to have been the people here that were here before the Celts arrived and became their priesthood. They were the ones who originally had built these stone circles. And, okay, so it's been passed on all the way down. How can we trace it back further and earlier than the Orkney Isles 5,000 years ago? Well, the stone circle that you showed on screen a short while ago, the one on the Orkney Isles, I said, the Ring of Brodgar, exact the one, yeah, there it is. Exactly the same stone circle as that. That's about 300 feet across, I think. You can see the little people there, so you can kind of work it out. It's pretty big. About a few miles off the coast of the Orkneys, on what was once the coast of Doggerland, there was the underwater archaeological surveys discovered with sonar and radar and so forth, an underwater stone circle that was exactly the same as that. The ring and embankment and the stones, they were all there under the sea. And the depth down showed it must have sunk at around 4,000 BC. So 1,000 years before the very first stone circle was erected in the British Isles was when this stone circle was there already. 1,000 years before, that's 6,000 years ago, which, apart from anything else, pretty much proves that the stone building civilization, the megalithic people of Britain, came originally from Doggerland, and that this may have been where it developed. Other things that show, I mean, that was only recently discovered. Other stone circles have now been discovered throughout the North Sea, north of Britain, smaller stone circles that have yet to be excavated by archaeologists. We hope to hear some news from that soon. They're keeping it very quiet as to where they found them in case other people go diving in search of treasures.
Sure.
So until they tell us, until they've done the excavations, the underwater archaeology, which, as you can probably appreciate, takes time, we're not going to know exactly where they are and the extent of this, but I would imagine it'll prove to be pretty similar to what the stone circle distribution was in Britain. But one part of Doggerland still survives above sea. It's a little tiny island called Fair Isle, only a couple of miles wide. It's right up the top, just off your map there. You can see it goes north. There's a little tiny island about 30 miles north of the Orkney Isles to the north of Britain. And on this island, no one really thought to actually do any archaeological excavations there on account of the fact that nobody thought anybody had lived there. But once they realized that there was people living on Doggerland and they had quite a sophisticated civilization, archaeologists have decided to excavate there. And what they found is found dwellings. I mean, this would have been high land, a mountain, if you like, or a high hill at the very extreme north of Doggerland. So they didn't sink. And maybe some people went there after the island had sunk and established small colonies. Now, little tiny villages have been found, but of the most sophisticated kind. They're built under the ground. They're underground villages to protect them from the weather, and they're connected by tunnels, amazing brickwork. They've even got sophisticated plumbing system, open channels that bring them fresh water, and a sewage system. For you know, these people had plumbing way before anybody else ever developed it. And even the Egyptians hadn't got anything like this.
Yeah,
I mean, but this was at least 6,000 years old, way before ancient Egypt. And they also discovered a couple of buildings, which they were a mystery at first because there was all this charred, this charcoal found there. They thought, well, they're not kilns, they're not burning, they're not firing pottery because there's no kiln there. Mm. It was only eventually that they realized that they were saunas. Now, these saunas were there at least 2,000 years before the oldest saunas had previously been discovered in Finland. Wow. So, and most remarkably of all, they built these walls, obviously, to try and hold back the waters as they got higher. And what they did was they were able to create fires around the wall to heat it to such an extent that they melted the rock to create a solid wall. This has been known that civilizations have done this, but many, many centuries later.
Yeah.
So these people were highly sophisticated, and they have to be the civilization that eventually went on to found the megalithic civilization in Britain.
Wow. Wow.
And they were completely unknown until a few years ago.
And you know, you'd be talking pre-Bronze Age, early Bronze Age, once again, possibly using copper tools, things like that. Is there any show of that in any of the stonework, things like that?
There are copper tools that have been found, but they're pretty useless. It just bends. Copper, gold, and silver were being smelted there, and they was in certain parts of the world being smelted, but it's only for jewelry and ornamental purposes. You can't use them as tools. They're too soft.
Yeah.
The Bronze Age didn't start until about at least 2,000 years before these people were doing what they were doing on Fair Isle. And even the stone circles, the first stone circles that were built in Britain, were being built 1,000 or at the very least 500 years before the Bronze Age ever got to Britain. And we know that they were using Stone Age tools because the remains of them have been found in their monuments and the mounds they built that got broken and left behind. Antlers of animals for picks, the shoulder blades of oxen for shovels, baskets for moving soil and stuff around, and flint and stone axes. They were doing this stuff with the most primitive kind of tools imaginable. It must have taken hours and hours and days and years and everybody working together to construct these massive monuments. So they were very important to a civilization that somehow held itself together in Britain for at least 2,000 years, and if you take the Doggerland before that, many, many thousands of years, without falling apart, or even there's no evidence that these people ever fought each other or had any disagreements. There's no defences built around their settlements. Mm. The ring and embankments around the stone circle are built the wrong way round for defences. The ditch is on the inside of the embankment, which is just ludicrous for defense. So they lived in peace for centuries.
Yeah. And, you know, that is a really good point. It's not like it would make for a good fort or anything like that necessarily. And
well, you look at that. I mean, that picture there the ditch and embankment were much, very much higher. You can see the water there. I mean, the wind and rain and stuff that blows off the Atlantic and the North Sea basically has filled in these ditches, but you can still see where it might have been. And if you look on the right-hand side of that picture, just above where the logo, oh, you've got logos all up. If you look at the logo, there you can make out that that is the embankment and there's the ditch.
Yeah.
And then it goes up again to the actual circle. Why build an embankment on the inside of a ditch? The idea, when you get hill forts that were built later, the ditch is on the outside, so the attacking army or the attacking people are going to get bogged down in a ditch, go through water or whatever, then have to climb up a hill to a stockade at the top. You wouldn't have the stockade and the outer embankment and then the ditch, so it's built for some other as yet completely unknown purpose.
Wow.
And it took the people, it would have taken them years to build this.
Yeah.
And they kept doing it over the centuries.
And I know it was recently found with Stonehenge specifically that it actively had some acoustic properties as well, with some of the standing stones as far as amplification, things like that. Have any of the other sites shown anything like that? Shown any kind of directional sound use or anything of that sort?
I haven't actually looked into that myself. There was one. I know that sometimes you have to be careful with these findings. There was a particular stone circle. I'm not going to mention which one it was, you'll see why in a minute. But there was a stone circle that attracted the interest of researchers some years back, and they set up all sorts of scanning equipment there to see if they could pick up any strange vibrations coming from stones. And they did. They picked up all sorts of strange signals. There was like many sort of, I don't know what you measure signals in megahertz and stuff. It was like literally like these stones were beaming out signals.
Wow.
And this was quite a well-known stone circle in Britain, in England. And people, you know, went there. There was TV shows that they brought in experts to read the soundings. And they said, this is broadcasting sort of radar and stuff like this into space. It's astonishing. And some of the top scientists were talking about this. And I remember at the time, it was years ago, and I was getting really excited. I thought, wow, this has got to be alien technology. Then the Cold War ended, and it was discovered that directly underneath where stone circle was, there was some sort of bunker that was entered. Because it was on top of a hill. It was perfect for an early warning place. And I remember some guy said he camped there one night, and an army truck turned up full of soldiers and went across the road and went and suddenly disappeared in this bushes. Whatever he thought was manhole cover, they went down it. And it was there because after the Cold War, when this was abandoned, the place was open and we went down there. Somebody burnt the place out and it was all wires hanging down. A couple of little rooms where guys would have sat always manned to track, you know, send out radar stuff to see if the Russians were coming. And basically it's all been filled in now and you wouldn't even know it was there. But they were picking up. They really were picking up radar.
Wow.
But it wasn't coming from the stone. It
wasn't coming
from
the stone.
But anyway, that's one of the only stories I know about people researching strange effects.
Well, you know, and there have long been stories of ley lines, lines of like an earth grid almost of connected energy across not only the earth, but where sacred sites themselves are built. Stonehenge, there's a whole line of stone circles and other things that just kind of seem to line up. It's really interesting when you start looking at that stuff. It's kind of like we mention on the show regularly. It's one thing if you're going to research Bigfoot. It's one thing if you're going to research a portal. When you have Bigfoot walk out of a portal, which side do you start researching from? You know, and when you when you've got ancient stone circles and ley lines, which one do you prove first? Which direction do you start researching that from? There's been tons of hypotheses about the location of these stone circles and why they were put at the locations that they're at.
The thing about ley lines, ley lines themselves, the idea that stone circles were connected to other stone circles by alignments of stone is real over short distances. I mean, there's many stone circles that have alignments of stones. You've got one, and then half a mile away, you have another and another one in a straight line for a couple of miles to another stone circle. There's no doubt about this. And why they did this, we don't know. Maybe they were mapping out some kind of geomantic earth current. Who knows what they were doing? But they did that. But then there's a guy called Alfred Watkins in the 1930s, I think it was, who was the first one to suggest that stone circles and stone standing stones, of which there are thousands all over the British Isles, were laid out to connect these stone circles in a grid which went all over the British Isles. He believed that there were pathways, and he called his book The Old Straight Track. Then in the 1960s, there was an English guy called John Michell, who was kind of like king of the hippies of Glastonbury in Somerset. And he said, he was a good researcher, don't get me wrong, but he was a bit of a hippie, well, a lot of one, I think. And he said that these stones, alignments of stones, which had been called ley lines by Watkins, he said that they were transmitting energy from stone circle to stone circle. And he gained a massive following. And when people all over the world today talk about ley lines being everywhere, they forget really that it was this guy, John Michell from England, who got the whole thing going. And the little Englishman who kind of came up with the term ley lines, who wrote a book that nobody ever really read in the 1930s. Mm. But what John Michell started to do, and also Watkins, they said, because a lot of these stone circles and standing stones no longer exist, you know, obviously thousands of years have gone by.
Yeah.
The early Christians built their churches on sites of stone circles, not on the stone circles, put up churches so that people would still go to a sacred site that they knew about, and that to prove that the God of the Christians had taken over from the ancient gods. And on standing stones, they may have built other Christian temples, this sort of thing. And Roman sites were sometimes based on where they had earlier religious sites. Now, the thing was that people started plotting ley lines. They'd get a map and they'd plot ley lines. They'd put a pin in the map every place where you've got a stone circle or a standing stone. But also they were putting them in churches, not just very old churches that we know that were associated with could have been had a very early church put there when the Romans first took over, adopted Christianity. But they were putting them in all sorts of churches. Yeah. And they were putting them in old mounds, hill forts, which were built by the Celts as defensive places. And so you'd got loads of these sites on books about ley lines that have got nothing, could have had nothing to do with the ancient megalithic people, which basically gave it rather a bad name. So the scientific community, or say that the archaeological community, say, oh, ley lines are just silly. Yes, if you're going to use every sort of site, even post offices anything you like. I mean, yes, but if you take away all that and just put pins in maps on stone circles and standing stones, you do find that against the possibility of chance, they do tend to be lining up over large distances.
Now, granted, a lot of that, once again, especially if you are tracing back the use of them to those astronomic alignments, specific times of year for harvesting sacred plants, that kind of stuff, it would make sense that they would be in direct alignment with each other so that, you know, they have the same alignment to the same stones. If you travel from one place to another as a healer, going to a stone circle locally, you would be looking basically at the same stone to get the same alignment, you know, in that hypothesis anyway.
Yeah. I mean, on the other hand, I mean, that's you know, if you're looking at the kind of practical purposes of it, then from a religious perspective, I suppose you could imagine the smaller stone circles like a parish church, the large stone circles like Avebury and Stonehenge as cathedrals, and these individual standing stones in between, like shrines that you get in Ireland and Catholic countries. Beside the road, you get a Virgin Mary shrine or a Holy One, things like this. And it's the same principle, I suppose.
Which very much, as you mentioned in your book, many of those standing stones were converted into Celtic crosses just out in the middle of fields, things like that, as Christianity moved in. A lot of those are obscured, gone, destroyed. Stones were used in the building of churches. And then even once again, the idea of Stonehenge being in the state it is, hey, man, farmers just came and took stones. They're like, look, I'm building a wall. I need some stones. There's a bunch sitting over there. It'd been there so long, they didn't really consider it an archaeological site at the time. You know,
there was a Roman writer who wanted to try and record where the various, what he called Celtic sites were, the stone circles. He had no idea that they were there even, you know, centuries before the Celts arrived. But he actually mentions the site of a few stone circles, and a very large one is in London, now covered over by London. And the interesting thing is, it's right in the middle of where Wembley Stadium is now, where they play the biggest football stadium, biggest soccer stadium in Britain. And it's right smack bang in the middle of it. I mean, I tried to look into why did they build Wembley Stadium there? Was it that there was a park area where somebody had preserved this stone circle? But they just said no. Apparently, the reason it was built there, it was just convenient. The land was up for sale when they first. In fact, the original Wembley Stadium was built for the Olympics back earlier in the 20th century. So it had nothing to do with. It's almost as if there was some kind of pull. For if these places where people went to worship or went to feel some energy or went to do something weird, they were drawn there. And maybe by the same token today, people are decided to be drawn there and build this biggest stadium in Britain in that area. I mean, it'd be interesting to see how many football stadiums and or soccer and whatever else are actually built on ancient stone circles. I mean, it's, you know, absolutely. This is not necessarily a serious study, but I find it interesting that Wembley Stadium is known as the sacred turf.
Well, you know, and what I find really interesting is, once again, like you were saying, that when the Celts got there, they didn't know what these stone circles were used for. It very much reminds me of America's Stonehenge and Dennis Stone, whenever we have him on. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, well, you know, the Native Americans in the area built it. Well, that's funny. When the Anglos came and found the ruins, they asked the Native Americans, what's this all about? They're like, I don't know. That was here when we got here. I have no idea what that was used for. And it was very much the same thing with the Celts. They didn't use the stone circles necessarily. They just came across them.
Yeah, a lot of it. The Druids, though, who said they were here before, because they lived outside civilized, they were kind of like Tibetan monks used to live in Tibet, Buddhist monks in Tibet. They lived outside society, except in this case, they weren't sort of segregated by sex. They were both men and women, and families were Druids, but they lived outside normal society. From the burials that are being found, they're genetically different to most of the people who were the megalithic people. But even the megalithic people were lots of different people. They started off being whoever it was that came down from the Orkneys and was in Britain already. They're known as the Neolithic people. Then came the so-called beaker people because of their custom of burying their dead with a beaker or cup. And they arrived from what's now Belgium, I think, or Holland, somewhere in the Low Countries, the Netherlands. They came to Britain around 2500. And then another people called the Wessex culture from, again, the same sort of area in Northern Europe came here. And another culture called the Urnfield culture. They were all very different. And we know they kept going with their same religious and local customs because of the way they buried their dead, very different from each other. Mm. Yet there was no fighting. They adopted the stone circles just like the earlier people had done, and even helped the first of them, the Beaker people, even helped to build Stonehenge, even though they had completely different religious beliefs based on their way that they buried their dead from the earlier people. Yet they still thought it was well worth building all these stone circles at great expense and time and effort. So they must have had some extraordinary practical purpose, maybe to do with the growing of crops and medicinal purposes and so forth, maybe something else entirely as well. But it must have been extraordinarily important and not just religious for them to all to have gotten involved in building these things and staying at peace with each other.
Yeah, I was just about to say it would have to be way beyond religious because, I mean, you'd have no vested interest in helping another religion build their temple. You know,
And we know they help build these places because we find their remains alongside the native British remains. And the same with the Wessex culture and the Urnfield culture. They Urnfield culture came to Britain from as far away as Germany and had totally different beliefs. They buried their dead in something called a cist, they buried their dead in urns. Cremated their dead, buried them in urns, hence Urnfield culture, in graveyards or fields. The Wessex culture buried their people they came from Belgium, in what's known as cists. They're kind of a coffin made of stones under them, and then they laid in this stone coffin and then covered with a mound. They all buried their dead very differently. Mm. So they carried on with their cultural beliefs and their religious beliefs, but all helped build the stone circles. I mean, there must have been something pulling them together, and there had to be a practical reason. Some people have even suggested they could teleport around the country. I've never seen known of anybody vanish at a stone circle, but it must have been something pretty spectacular, whatever they were doing it for.
Well absolutely. And, whenever we had you on talking about the Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge, of course, one of the many myths that has existed for the longest time. I mean, even in ancient times, they said that Merlin built the stone circles, that he mystically brought stones from somewhere else, from where he came from. Now, is there any connection to that story of Merlin or magic connected with the other circles as well?
Well, the Stonehenge myths, it's quite interesting that some of the myths of Stonehenge seem to have been based on a kind of a shared memory of real events. Mm. It's said that Merlin built the stone circle there. Obviously, the historical Merlin, if he existed in Arthur's time, that was 1,500 years ago. Stonehenge was built 2,000 years before that. So it's obviously got, 2,500 years before that. So, no, 3,000 years before, a long time anyway.
Yeah.
So Stonehenge, 2,500 BC, Merlin, 500 AD. So he couldn't have actually, if he did exist and been associated with King Arthur, couldn't have built Stonehenge. But the myth is that he magically transported the stones from Ireland to make Stonehenge. We now know that the stones that were used to build Stonehenge were actually dragged or floated on barges all the way from South Wales to recreate Stonehenge when the people moved from South Wales into central England. They built the stone circle with them, brought the stone circle with them. And the people in South Wales, on the coast of South Wales, had come from Ireland. So the stone circle may originally have been in Ireland and been transported to where Stonehenge is, but not by Merlin. But the story that remained, that the stones somehow came from Ireland, must have required for people in ancient times some sort of, or certainly people in the Middle Ages when these stories came about, you know, we've heard from the local people that the stones came from Ireland. How could they get there? Only by magic. It must have been Merlin.
Well, and even the idea of the stone circle and the technology of the stone circle coming from a mythical place, a place that existed before, somewhere that was magical, somewhere like Doggerland, where quite literally this civilization disappeared as did the stone circle that it had.
The Celts that survived in Ireland, because Ireland was never conquered by the Romans, when they were Christianized in the 400s, the Celts told Irish monks who wrote down monks who were trying to convert the Irish, such as St. Patrick, in the 400s. People told them about their myths and legends, and they said that they believed the stone circles were originally created by a people who lived on a mystical island called Thule that existed to the north of Britain. So they even remembered this in a race memory of some.
Wow. Incredible. Incredible. And, you know, that is something that we talk about regularly on this show, Graham, is how fast we as a people, we as a humanity, lose touch with our past. You know, once again, go back to our great grandparents. You know, they were even connected with the earth in a different way. When the sun went down, it was nighttime. They didn't have lights. They didn't stay up till 1-2 a.m. on the internet, things like that. They went to bed. They woke up. They scrounged to survive. They lived off the land. They were connected to the earth in a different way. And we forget these things so rapidly. Even the idea of trades, and how fast they disappear in the modern age, will show you how rapidly the technology and knowledge of how to build a stone circle will disappear. Especially once the culture has changed, once, not necessarily the religion, but the medicinal use of things has changed culturally.
Absolutely. I mean, the way that the culture came to an end is when the Celtic people arrived, the climate had changed, and then they started, when the Celts arrived around 700 BC, they started building hill forts, fortifications around settlements. They had weapons that could be used for fighting. I mean, there's no evidence that anybody before this time was ever engaged in any kind of major warfare until around about 1000 BC, when some Bronze Age people, the proto-Celts, as they're known, came. They started building fortifications, and there's none of these before that time. And the reason why is not necessarily because the Celts were particularly violent. I mean, they had iron weapons, so they were much better for fighting. Even bronze weapons bend and break easily. But iron weapons, they could do proper warfare. But the reason why is it was getting colder. The climate in Britain changed, and people were fighting over what they had. You know, it wasn't the land of plenty anymore. So that's how the whole thing came to an end. And maybe the last of the people who were using the stone circles, the priesthood, the Druids, managed to survive. But most of the other people integrated with the Celts and became part of their culture.
It is interesting how specifically that whole area, Scotland, Ireland, UK, how tribally it did become a huge point of tribal warfare for, well, pretty much from that time up until almost modern time. It's pretty remarkable to see that, how they went from an area where there was no warfare, where they were not in competition with each other, though there may have been separate clans, what have you. It's not like there was clan warfare going on, like there was in the, 1500s, things like that.
No, I mean, that was what the clan warfare, if you like, was what kind of finished it off.
Yeah.
But they had survived. I mean, they had survived for at least 2,000 years in Britain, and maybe a couple of thousand, 3,000 years earlier than that in Doggerland. And what brought the civilization to an end in Doggerland meant that some of them could escape and come to Britain. But water rose gradually, and so they saw it coming. They could have got on boats. They had pretty sophisticated boats for the time, but you wouldn't need much more than a raft to get across to northern Britain. They could have escaped, and you'd think, well, if the water's coming up, why didn't far more of them come? Why only enough to go onto the Orkneys? Well, it seems at some point there was a massive tidal wave that completely swept over the island. And although it may have receded and it took many years later for the waters to rise and cover North Doggerland, enough damage had been done to pretty much wipe out the civilization. And this occurred because off the coast of Norway, there was a massive landslide. Because the ice had melted, all this huge areas of cliffs and terrain on the seaboard of Western Norway collapsed into the sea, causing a massive tidal wave, hundreds of feet tall, that just swept over the island. It pounded Britain, but there wasn't much civilization on the coast of Britain to be pounded. Most people here were still hunter-gatherers, and they remained inland. There were fishing villages. We don't probably know about them because they were pulverized.
Yeah.
But that's how the civilization ended. It ended in calamity, and the few that managed to survive did manage to embark, or were already beginning to settle on the Orkneys. The reason they didn't settle there before is because the Orkney Islands, the kind of soil they have there, is now and never was particularly inducive for growing wonderful crops. But their own land was much better. I mean, because the Orkneys was literally where the main winds and weather from the Atlantic roared in across that fairly low-lying area. It's pretty inhospitable, whereas Doggerland to the east of Britain seems to have been a much more fertile place. But in the end, the Orkneys was perhaps the only place that they were left to go.
Yeah.
But there were trees there in the past, which there aren't today.
Now, you're talking about this massive flood. Did that in any way correspond or correlate to, of course, the worldwide myths of a flood?
Yeah, there are worldwide myths of floods, and it's not necessarily this one particular Norwegian collapse of cliffs and things, yeah, this landslide that caused that. But this was happening elsewhere in the world. After the end of the last ice age, before the ice age, or before 10,000 BC, throughout the world, as far as we know, people were hunter-gatherers. They were basically nomadic people who moved from place to place as the seasons changed. You've got something like Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, which is a temple, quite a sophisticated stone circle-like temple,
yeah,
that was built around 10,000 years ago, earlier perhaps. And this was a kind of one-off almost, but it wasn't built by a people with a civilization that actually built villages and stayed in one place. It was built by nomadic people who came back to this area every so often. The first people who began to settle in, Göbekli Tepe, stone circles, not like the ones in Britain, but yeah, this is one of the earliest known temples or earliest monuments known anywhere in the world that have been built by humans. But after the Ice Age, people changed, strangely enough. People started to settle, and they learned how to grow crops. They invented agriculture, and they began to domesticate animals. Now, this only happened after the last Ice Age. Humans have been around for about 200,000 years and never got around to doing this. Suddenly they did. And what happened is it meant the beginning of proto-civilizations, early settlements, mainly around the sea, around the coastal areas, fishing and other kinds of farming. Now, there was many of these civilizations that existed throughout the world. They didn't have writing or anything, so whatever happened to them was passed down by word of mouth, oral tradition. But a lot of these literally sank beneath the waves when the sea started rising. It's risen between, over a good few centuries. It rose by 400 feet. This would have flooded most of these early civilizations. Yeah. Some of these early cultures do still survive. I mean, they've been excavated in places like Jericho in the West Bank. They've been excavated in Peru, in Bolivia, elsewhere in the world, but they were the ones inland. The ones on the coast were lost to the waves. And there would have been many of these huge tidal waves caused by collapsing landslides like the one in Norway, Nova Scotia, what's it called? Nova Scotia. There was one there in Canada that would have pounded the coast of of Northern Europe and the coast of North Africa. There was other ones that happened in Central America, in Africa. So there would have been many places where it would have been remembered that huge tidal waves flooded the whole area. This could have given rise to the early legends of a worldwide flood. The whole world wasn't flooded, but certainly
the world
many
that
of
they knew was flooded.
Were.
Well, and that's just it. You know, we have to remember that while many ancient civilizations, you know, knew that the earth was round, things like that, they didn't quite know the expanse of the earth. You know, it was pretty much the earth was as far as you could see. Or as far as you had traveled. So whenever they said that the whole earth was flooded, they were talking about what they knew was flooded, their localized area. And, you know, we know that ancient, through bog bodies, things like that, and other things that ancient cultures, especially in Ireland, had connection to, cultures in the Pyrenees. Things like that. Are there anything that show the connection or trade routes of these earlier civilizations to places beyond?
Yeah, what I find fascinating is that the Bible tells us the whole world was flooded. Hmm. So do a number of other ancients. I mean, the people who wrote the Bible probably got their ideas from the Babylonians, who also had very similar flood myths to the story of Noah.
Yeah.
What is interesting is that we know from the ancient Greeks that one of the reasons that people believed that the whole world was once flooded isn't just because of these tales that have been handed down of these floods, but also because people had gone to the top of high mountains, way above where the sea or water would ever be, except for rainwater, and they found in the rocks shells. They were fossilized shells, and they'd been actually formed into the rock when that was sea level, and then pressures that take place over the years, geological pressures push up mountains, and that's how shells that are millions of years old end up at the top of mountains. They didn't know this and thought that at one point the sea must have been higher than the top of these very high mountains. So it comes down to fossils. As the first person to actually realize that this wasn't the case, and there must be some other reason, was Leonardo da Vinci in the 1400s, in the late 1400s. He went up hills and he said he sees these shells here, and he thinks that this is why people thought in biblical times that there'd been a flood throughout the world. But he said these kind of shells do not, they're from shellfish that don't come from this part of the world. He'd traveled widely and he'd seen, and he said they must have, the whole rock must have moved somehow. So it's not a case of a flood, it's a case of moving mountains. Yeah. I mean, he didn't know why, but now we know of plate tectonics, we know he was right. So that's quite fascinating, I find.
That is really fascinating, and I had never heard that. But as someone who is into geology and rocks and minerals and fossils, it makes utter sense. Like, logically, it makes utter sense. Much like the recent discovery of the huge water beast there in the hills of the UK. I guarantee you that finding fossils of waterbound dinosaurs, things like that, finding skulls of them in the hills, led to stories of dragons, things like that, you know, very much in the same way, where they saw a fossil in a cave somewhere, and there's a dragon in that cave, man, watch out, because they ran across something in the wall somewhere.
Well, if you look at the first in Genesis, the early part of the Bible, it talks about, and there were giants in the earth in those days. Somebody must have seen these giant skeletons in the earth. It specifically says in the earth, not on the earth, not roaming the earth, in the earth. So in other words, people were talking about fossils they'd seen.
Yeah.
I mean, if you saw a thing with a head the size of, you would think it was a monster.
Well,
you would think it was It is.
It is a monster. It's massive. It's huge. And that's just it. You know, it's something that we discuss regularly on this show, especially whenever it comes to ancient civilizations, Graham, is that we do not have to go to the extreme. We don't have to. We tend to really discount the ingenuity of humanity, despite them being an ancient people. Just because they were an ancient people doesn't mean that there weren't people like Archimedes, you know, who understood the basics of physics and how to move water against the grain, and move water uphill, that kind of stuff. There have always been these forward thinkers when it comes to humanity. There have always been these people who have grandiose, inventive, beautiful ideas. And yeah, you know, many of these people were seen as mystics in ancient civilizations, that kind of stuff. But we don't have to go to the extreme when it comes to why was Stonehenge built. I don't think we have to go to the world of necromancy. I don't think we have to go to the world of alien civilizations. I think the hypotheses that you put forward of it being an herbological calendar make utter sense, especially when you start looking at the only things that are found in grave sites near these places, you know, because once again, it's not like you're finding the grave of the king with his scepter and sword. It's not like you're finding the grave of soldiers or builders. The only thing you're finding is the graves of healers and herbs and the things that were used.
The healers, or the druids, as the Celts had called them, or at least the Romans and the Greeks referred to them as, were buried right next. They were the only people who were buried next to stone circles in what they call box tombs, a kind of stone chamber covered with a mound, about 18 feet long. The chamber was, and about 6 feet wide and about 6 feet tall. Two chambers. In one of the chambers, they'd bury the dead. In the other chambers, they'd put items that they were used in daily life, such as these pots containing medicinal substances, saws, which showed that they were doing amputations, and other implements, knives and that, which were being used for some kinds of surgery. Now, going back so before the Celts arrived, the megalithic people, the only people they buried near stone circles, were also buried in these exactly the same box tombs. Mm. And it shows that they were buried in the same way, which is archaeological evidence to suggest that when these people told the Romans that the Druids had been here before us, they were right, because you've got the same kind of burials. They were certainly the spiritual successors, if not the actual descendants of the people there before. And they seem to have remained fairly separate from the rest of society. So they were kind of, I don't know what you'd call them, sort of like insular society of druids who lived in separate places, not far from the stone circles, where the main settlements were much further away. So they were the ones who were using these. And so what do we know about the people who were associated with the stone circles? Not kings, as you said,
yeah,
not ordinary people. They were these druids, these priests, this priesthood, which we know had these phenomenal memories for everything. They were the libraries of a people without a form of writing, so they never had to develop a form of writing, because these people would remember and pass on the information. And so you end up with them being the ones that live near the stone circles. They're the ones that were using them, if you like, or in charge of them. What do they do? Well, we can tell from their graves, they were primarily healers. So you're going to have to say that the stone circles must have had a lot to do with healings. Were they the kind of health care centers of prehistoric times? You know, in some way they were associated. One way is by these places being used as calendars to decide when to grow the crops and so on, and when to harvest and all that. And maybe other things too. Maybe they believe there was some kind of energy coming to those places that could help with healing. I mean, as I say, I don't know any actual scientific evidence for this, but there are many things that science is discovering all the time that people didn't even know existed before. I mean, look at it this way. Without sonar and radar, we wouldn't even know that North Doggerland was even there, let alone had a civilization on it.
Other than, like you were saying earlier, the myths of the Celtic people and where the stone circles came from. and once again, that would be myth. And much like until science gives us that information, just like the finding of Troy, you know, that was myth until the day we actually found Troy. And oddly enough, right where it was supposed to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, there's archaeologists, they dig things up and scientifically analyze, you know, stuff. They're great with telling us what the date of something is, yeah, what some of these tools were used for, and so on. Now, then you've got historians, they consult ancient texts and tell us what people were doing. Well, obviously, this doesn't go back in Britain before the Romans arrived, but we can tell from what they've discovered from ancient texts, yeah, what the Romans tell us. So you've got the history and archaeology. But there's a bit in the middle. I mean, historians, archaeologists hardly ever talk to each other. They don't have joint conferences. Yeah. They don't have the same publications. They don't share research. So this is where I've come in and said, right, I've for years, since my first books, like 40 years ago, I've been saying, like, I'm looking at what the archaeologists have to say. Archaeologists over here, historians over here. Let's see what they're going to say, and let's see if there's some common ground. And I've been able to put together the pieces of the jigsaw that are in two separate places. But what I've also been able to do as a guide is use folklore and mythology, which both types tend to ignore altogether.
Yeah.
And this can tell us a lot. I mean, like we said about, if you took notice about, okay, you've got the story of Merlin bringing the stones from Ireland. Is there any truth in that? Well, maybe Merlin didn't do it, but the stones did come from Ireland. There's another story at Stonehenge, which again shows how myths and legends can go down through history and tell us something. There's a stone there called the Heel Stone, which stands outside the main stone circle. It's a big stone, and when you go there at midsummer's sunrise on midsummer's day, or the midsummer solstice, you'll see the sun rise directly over this stone. Now that's when all the druids go there, and crowds of people gather these days to see this. Now for years this was known as the Heel Stone, the reason being, and it wasn't until relatively recently that people appreciated it, that the sun rose over that stone on midsummer's morning. People in medieval times had weren't that interested in what it was there for. And the story that was told and written down in medieval times was that's the Heel Stone. The reason why it was called the Heel Stone is because there was once a friar, like a monk, like Friar Tuck, a friar who went to Stone Circle, the Stonehenge, and saw the devil was living in it. And the friar tried to banish the devil, failed, ran away, and in his anger, the devil picked up one of these big stones at St. Stonehenge and hurled it at the friar, just missed him, caught him on his heel, and that's why it's stuck in the ground there at an angle. That's where it remained. And it was called the Friar's Heel originally, then the Heel Stone. Well, Frios Heel is Greek for sunstone. It's also a very similar Frias Hail for the ancient Brythonic Celtic for sunstone. Heelstone means sunstone.
Wow.
So it was always called the sunstone, and it would be carried on throughout history. And someone who obviously didn't understand ancient Greek or the Celtic languages said, what's it called? Frias Heel. Friar's Heel. Oh.
Oh.
And then somebody made up a tale that went with it. So there's a lot of these stories. There's a story about a place down in Devonshire, Cornwall in the southwest of England, a tomb that dates from the megalithic period, when there is supposed to have been a druid or a holy man buried in this tomb. And apparently, I mean, it had been unopened for thousands of years. And when it was opened, it was found to contain the body of probably a single druid, and in one particular container, one particular annex of this tomb, there was this big golden beaker or cup. And the legend had existed there way before, that if people went to that area called Rillington Mount, Rillington Barrow, in the middle of the moorland and got lost and were thirsting, what would happen is this phantom druid would appear and give you a sip from this golden cup. So this story had been there for years until it was eventually opened, and it had never been opened before for centuries. And this story must have been passed on for centuries about who was buried there and what he had with him.
Wow. Wow. And once again, to like it, the thing that I love about your work is that you do incorporate archaeology, mythology, all of these things together and see them as a whole, which I consider hugely important. Because if we lose the stories, then we're losing part of the history of an area or an object or a civilization. And at least their understanding to be able to see things through their eyes because of their story, is massively important. And your work is voluminous and amazing, Graham. I want to thank you for coming on. It is always a great conversation, man. The book Mystery of Doggerland is epic, folks. Go out, get it. It is absolutely fascinating to go through and read about how this civilization existed in the North Sea and just slowly migrated down and kind of lost itself along the way. You know, it really is the story of how easily that is done, that we as humanity forget ourselves, forget our history, and forget places like Doggerland that were right there, that ancient civilizations told us about through their myths, history, things like that. So where can everybody go to get your books, follow your work? Everything else, I know you're always posting things on social media, but where can they go to, of course, other than our online store, to find you?
Well, there's your online store. There's Amazon. You can get it on Amazon in the UK or in the United States, mm-hmm. and most places in the world. Because it's published by Traditions, they've got, they provide a lot of bookshops with the books in the States and in the UK as well. And but if you go to my website, grahamphillips.net, there it is, grahamphillips.net. On the front page, you will see all the books that most of the books I've published. All you need to do is click on one of them, and you'll then get pages of all about it. Oh, and just click on one of them, try that one.
There we go.
Click on that one. There we go. And if you go down, you go all the way down and you see all about the book. And then if you go to a next page, which you can click on at the bottom, you've got photographs, pictures of the legend. Oh. That one's about Merlin, but whatever. So there's plenty there to tell you all about the books. And that's grahamphillips.net. And on the front page, you'll see the links to my Facebook and YouTube channel. There you go. There they all are. YouTube channel, Facebook, IMDb, which has got all my TV appearances, which I do quite a lot of. And there we go. That's my YouTube channel. It's something anyway. Whatever it is. Oh, Facebook.
That's your Facebook.
There I am, looking slightly younger than I do now.
I was most impressed the other day. I'm trying to remember which show it was that I was watching. I've always got like one of the, unidentified, all kinds of shows going on just in the background as I'm working on my computer in the living room. And I was watching something about the Holy Grail, and I forget show it was. And
I've done quite a few on that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But as my wife walked into the kitchen, she heard your voice and she was like, "Oh, is that Graham Phillips?" I was like, "Yeah, all right." Awesome. So yeah, you can be found on all as a talking head on all kinds of shows. Once again,
the latest one on the Grail I did is something that was on the show that Lawrence Fishburne presented.
Yes. That was the one, actually. So, it's always great whenever I get to see you. Your work is voluminous and amazing. I need to have you on to talk about Strange Fate very soon. So that is your other new book. You are always working, always doing great stuff. Thank you so much for your time, Graham. I appreciate it. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online, everybody, checking out all of the amazing work of our guest, Graham Phillips, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/store is where you can find all of the books from our guests, curiousrealm.com/video. Ooh, I don't know why that's not loading. that is where you can go to actively follow all of the video feeds and YouTube channels of our guests, as well as ours, and like, follow, subscribe. I guarantee you it works, folks. Thank you so much
for tuning in, as always, everybody. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Remember, the conversation is the important thing. Open hearts, open minds, change the world. Stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.